Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Take a walk through your neighborhood, and you're probably surrounded by more food than you realize. That patch of dandelions in the sidewalk crack, the mulberry tree dropping fruit that nobody picks up, the weeds somebody just paid to have pulled. Depending on who you ask, those plants are trash or dinner. My guest today has spent years examining that gap. Meg Bartley is a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Utah and the public health coordinator for the city of Holladay. She's also a professional chef and public scholar who studies something deceptively simple. Who decides what counts as food and who and what gets left out of that conversation and definition? Today we're here to talk about urban foraging, not just as a hobby, but also as a lens on public health, access, and the plants growing right outside our doors. Meg, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Great. Well, you sit in an interesting, unusual intersection: anthropology, public health, professional cooking. How did those three threads end up converging on urban foraging specifically?
I started out as a chef. So I actually did not graduate high school, so this is kind of deep lore about me. I was a GED graduate, and so one of the job opportunities that was available to me where I could make a good living was in the culinary industry. So I kind of worked my way up to executive chef over many, many years, and was really fortunate as the executive chef, pastry chef of Snowbird. They paid for me to have some formal training in the culinary arts, which was really, I'm so grateful for to this day. So over time, I really regretted that I didn't have the kind of education that I wanted. Specifically when they would ask me to do things like write a bio, and it was just riddled with typos. I mean, not even typos,
this
just
is
like
pre-AI,
misspellings.
You know? I know. You're just trying to do human things.
Just trying to do human things. I remember specifically not being able to spell the word grateful. I mean, just for, you know, example.
Yeah.
And eventually I decided I wanted to go back to school. This was right around 2011. And as I mentioned, I was an executive chef at this time. So continued to work throughout my undergrad degree as a chef, and then at some point realizing that I didn't have to follow a traditional path, that I actually could become an anthropologist and follow these other dreams and aspirations of mine, and that I'm really fortunate that there is this intersection with food, and that tends to intersect really nicely with my focus on the social determinants of health, which includes things like access to healthy, fresh food and forced food pathways, which we'll get into a little bit later, and anthropology and cooking. So it all just kind of came together.
Isn't it funny how in retrospect it always feels like it evolved so naturally and organically? Of course all these things go together so beautifully, but in the moment sometimes you wonder how all the pieces are gonna fit.
Yep.
Well, let's just dive right in. Like, most people walk past a dandelion or a patch of weeds without a second glance. Mm-hmm. What kind of things made you start seeing city spaces as a place where food is actually everywhere?
It happened. It was kind of a funny incident where I had spent the morning weeding and tossing out dandelions specifically. So pulling them, just like spending a bunch of time pulling them out of my yard, trying really hard to get all the roots. I didn't want them coming back, just feeling like they were such an inconvenience to me. And then later that day, I went to the store, actually to the farmer's market, where I purchased dandelion greens. And I began to just feel really stupid. And some of the dandelion greens had the roots on them, and I just had this just feeling of, I just threw this away.
Yeah.
And it was free, and now it's something like $6 to $9 per bushel, depending on the size. So I just felt really silly in that moment and thought, you know, I'm putting all this poison onto my lawn, I'm spending all of this time like pulling weeds, and these are edibles. And I only really knew about dandelions at that point as an edible green, because here I am purchasing it. So I began looking into it, and I was really surprised to learn how many of the social norms and the laws that regulate food procurement really tend to harm specific populations more than others, and to prohibit the acquisition of fresh and healthy food for the people who really need it most.
Well, I think many of us have heard about food deserts, people mm-hmm. who live in urban areas where they're just access to fresh, healthy foods is not easy, nor is it very affordable.
Right.
And now to hear more, we had an earlier guest this season who created the farm shares up at Saco's Farmers Market, and they're making it a year-round situation. But she was talking too about how the legislation around what you can sell, how you have to process the foods in order to make it safe, which is theoretically important that we are having safeguards for this stuff, but how it can get in the way of that access. Can you share a little bit more about what you've experienced with that or seen around that?
Well, one thing that comes to mind, some of this is a deep history, and you can go back to shortly after the prohibition of slavery, where freed Black Americans were trying to make their own way. They didn't want to be reliant on the same plantations that they were just freed from, servitude, and so from enslavement. And so they wanted to find their own paths, and they were often looking toward foraging, and they had become really adept at foraging in many cases. Harriet Tubman was a famous naturalist, which a lot of people don't know. But enslaved peoples were fed really starvation rations, and often, just not enough to survive. And so had been for years learning about the natural ecology around them and supplementing their diets with foraged foods. And so by passing things like no trespassing laws and anti-foraging laws and making those types of things illegal, it forced freed people back into servitude, essentially mm-hmm. on the exact same plantations that they had just been, freed from that enslavement.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Really heartbreaking. And so a lot of people don't understand, or haven't looked back to see where a lot of these no trespassing laws come from. And it does affect the Intermountain West. This, again, is like such a deep and broad topic. One way that I've felt it as a chef when I'm trying to do public presentations, I can't really bring foraged foods and serve them to people because be on the up and up with the health department, which is okay.
Yeah.
I completely understand it.
If you've grown them in your garden, a natural food, would that have been okay?
If there had been if I could tell them where it was sourced, but when it's just like, I sourced it in this public, on these, public lands where there's not anti-foraging laws in place, because there are anti-foraging laws in some public lands, like national parks are a great example of that. So even if I'm able to tell them where it's been procured, it's just too much of a sticky situation. And I completely understand that I work with the health department all the time. I absolutely have respect and admiration for the important work that they do, so I'm not trying to say that that's not important.
Sure.
But rather that it can be prohibitive when you're trying to demonstrate these things to a widespread audience. Mm. Another thing that I've run into, I mentioned to you that I had just gotten done a chefing gig for Bugfest
mm-hmm,
at
right.
the Natural History Museum of Utah.
Right.
So this is a year or an annual celebration of all things related to bugs, including entomophagy, which is human consumption of insects.
And chapul, right?
Yes.
The cricket flower?
Absolutely. Chapulines are like the crickets that you can get. We import them from the Oaxaca region.
But I actually don't know hardly anything, but I was proud of myself for thinking of the word chapul because I thought I heard
good.
It one time.
Yeah, it was perfect. Spot on.
Thank you.
Yes. And I know that was a little bit of an uphill battle, just to get health department approval. And it was great, and they were wonderful to work with, but we did have to demonstrate that we were sourcing them from a reputable and reliable source where these are insects that are cultivated for human consumption specifically.
Do you feel I think it's an understandable thing that across different cultures, different parts of the world, different amounts of development in areas that we agree culturally whether something is good to eat or not, whether one should eat a rabbit or a cow or a dog or a horse. There's an ick factor for a lot of people about animal consumption across different cultures.
Sure.
But what kind of pushback do you experience from people? Do they think it's unsafe? Do they think it's gross? Do they think it's weird? What's the pros and cons that you hear from people when they're introduced to the idea of foraging?
Well, there's a lot of people who like to there's a lot of people who might politicize it. So I do see politicization of the concept of urban foraging, where somehow people really let it get under their skins and they feel like I'm trying to tell them that they have to live a specific way, which of course is never my goal. Rather, just to introduce the concept and to talk about the history of these laws and norms, and really call it, a lot of these norms just exist without people being conscious of them.
Yeah.
So just calling attention to the fact that these norms exist and asking the exact question that you just asked, why is this ick? Why mm-hmm. do you find this so gross? And mm-hmm. some people, there's just a variation in how adventurous people are when it comes to eating. And I love a good adventurous eater, like somebody who's just ready to try it. Even if they find it a little bit disquieting, they're just going to give it a go and see what they think and, you know, reserve their judgment for after, you know, after that bite.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And mm-hmm. I mean, even in this country 30 years ago, sushi was exotic, you know, right? And
yes.
And now, I mean, you can buy sushi in an upscale gas station. It's fantastic. I mean, it might be sketchy sushi, but... And then, like, as a chef, that must be a really interesting part of this equation. So do you find yourself evaluating the different foods based on, like, what you might do with them or thinking about different ways? Or is it just part of the whole picture for you?
As far as doing, you know, kind of the more educational chef gigs, which is all I do these days, I really...
Oh, nice.
Unless... I have a loved one who wants me to do a wedding cake or something. That's like an exception that I'll make. But for the most part, you know, I really only do educational chefing gigs, like Bugfest, or I have one coming up in Moab for the Youth Garden Project, for example. So I initially, when it came up, it was the Natural History Museum of Utah finding out that I was employed there at the time, and they found out that I was a chef. And they asked me if I knew of anyone who might be interested in talking about urban foraging. And I said, well, you don't know this, but I am that person.
I actually do know someone. Yeah. Yes, quite well.
I just said, well, that's me, actually. And so we came up with an initial workshop together. And then kind of the same type of conversation emerged over Bugfest. And do you know, and really they just initially asked me about my thoughts on how Bugfest had been run and the Bug Bar, where there was kind of a focus on the ick factor and, you know, ew, we're all going to try bugs and isn't this kind of fear factor.
Yeah,
exactly. And I just said, you know, that isn't the approach that I would take. I would take the approach that these things are, that these dishes can be delicious and we know they're nutritious and sustainable. So I would really want to go in that direction. And I didn't know what to anticipate, and I didn't know what insects really tasted like. It was new for me, so mm-hmm. I had to source a bunch of them and then do some test recipes. And over time, I learned that, I will say like year two, I thought that I really had it down because I had tested all of these different insects, and I thought, okay, I know what they all taste like now. I know what a cricket tastes like. I know what grasshoppers taste like. I know what termites taste like, etc. What I didn't understand about insects at that time was that their flavor is so dependent on the environment in which they're cultivated.
Oh.
And so it can taste one way from one source and then a completely different way from another source.
Makes sense, I guess.
Yeah. Yep. And there is a real gaminess to them. So they are, you know, for the most part, even when they're cultivated, they still have kind of a wild, gamey flavor and an earthy flavor mm-hmm. across the board, regardless of which insect you're talking about. So anyway, I did have to learn about all of that. Yeah. When it came to weeds, that I had been doing for such a long time that it developed in a more, less of a forced atmosphere, I would say, less of a time crunch and more of a genuine and deep interest in something that I really love to do and love experimenting with and really enjoy. I mean, who doesn't love to go on a walk and grab some food for dinner? It's so fun, and it's such a wonderful connection with the environment. It helps me appreciate it a little bit more. I know that there's, you know, more micronutrients, more nutritional value in general.
And more diversity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if a person is curious about this and they're hiking regularly in an area that is probably not treated with pesticides and various things, because most of our natural hiking trails and stuff like that, what would be a good thing for them to start? Would just picking a dandelion leaf, and could you nibble on it, or would you always, you're a public health person, also recommend that they wash it, or like how would they start this whole process?
Yeah, I do. I recommend just always knowing water sources, first of all. So not just if it's been treated. You should be aware of that before sourcing anything. Are they treating it with pesticides or herbicides? And then secondly, you want to ensure that the water source in and of itself is not contaminated. And then once you know those things, you're good to go. So I can't speak for everyone else, but I always have water with me, and I do give things a quick rinse.
Sure.
If for no other reason, because, you know, there's wild game around that those are their facilities, if you will. So you just want to wash them just to be safe. And not necessarily just for the chemicals, but for other things that could be on them and dirt. So, you can absolutely just nibble, I'd say, once you give it a wash. And I personally, for dandelions, my favorite part is the root.
Oh.
Especially if it's a fresh root. So roots vary in their utility, essentially. Like some of them are really good roasted and they're not going to be very bitter, but if they've been in the ground for a long time and this is like a more mature plant, they will start to get bitter, and you can tell because they'll darken in color and they'll get really dry. And if that's the case, then you can make your dandelion root coffee beverage, which
I've heard
you can do
that.
Like a brewed coffee, dandelion root beverage, which is wonderful.
And do you roast? Do you like grind it and roast it? How would you do that?
Yeah, so you want to roast it, and you get it to where it's darkened, and it will start to smell.
Some aromatics, kind of.
And it does have kind of a bitter coffee-like flavor, and it doesn't naturally have caffeine, but some people would say it's psychosomatic, but it does tend, like there are both anecdotes and some small-scale I don't want to say studies, but like small scale research that doesn't indicate that
there's a lift from
it. There's a little
lift.
You get a little boost.
Maybe
it's
you
not
just
the same
feel
as caffeine.
No, maybe you just feel good that you're using your environment and you're living with the land.
Yeah, something about it. And it could really just be that it tastes like coffee, and that we all associate coffee so much. There's that like kind of Pavlovian response to when you smell coffee in the morning, even though it takes 20 minutes for that caffeine to like actually give you the boost. But we've all had that experience of just smelling it and going, oh, wow, I feel awake now.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing applies here. So it can give you a really natural lift, and it's delicious and healthy. Huh. Yeah.
And you said that sometimes it's really good if they're roasted. How would you use a roasted dandelion root?
One of my favorite things is to, and I don't do this as often as I should. My husband always listens to these interviews, and he's just like, you don't really do that very often. So I might as well make it when I get home tonight. But you, of course, scrub it really well. If it has a lot of like offshoots, you want to like kind of peel those off. And then just spritz it with olive oil or a neutral oil. It works as well. Like you could use like an avocado oil and salt and pepper, and then just roast it. And it's delicious.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love that. I just love thinking that there's always more that we're discovering in the world around us.
And dandelions are extremely versatile, so you can use the flower itself for dandelion wine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there's so many recipes for dandelion wine. You can just look one up.
Is it good?
I like it, but I don't know. I'm an adventurous eater.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I can't believe it. We're almost out of time, but
one thing I want to plug really quick,
because
this is fall.
Please.
Purslin or purslane. I mean, there's variation in the way that people pronounce this across the U.S. But it is a fall succulent. Most people would call it a weed, but in other parts of the world, including in areas in Europe, it is cultivated as a plant that you can
For
food.
Salad leaf?
You can use it. It's
what kind of plant is it? I'm not familiar.
It is a succulent. Like it has plump leaves. You've definitely seen it growing. It loves cracks. It loves to grow in the cracks. If you've seen those kind of spider webby.
Sure.
Like with the plump leaves, and they have kind of reddish vine. They're not really vines, but the reddish stems.
Okay.
Anyway, so check it out. Like you want to check it out on something like iNaturalist or use an app to ensure that that's what you're getting.
Sure.
Look it up. Make sure you know what you're getting because there are some lookalikes that you don't want to eat. But it is so wonderfully delicious. It has a lemon pepper flavor. Mm. I like to make pesto out of it.
Pesto is such a wonderful concept, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You can play around with different ingredients, different nuts, different oils, different greens. It's so exciting what you can do with it.
Yep.
Wow. All right. And you mentioned iNaturalist. Can you give our listeners a couple more resources that if they want to dive deeper into this or if you have any classes coming up that they should check out?
Ooh, I don't have any workshops, but I typically will do two. I just watch the Natural History Museum of Utah. It's the place where I most frequently will put on workshops of this type. And I know that they annually have had a Women in Science event. I typically present on this topic. They do that annually. And they also have Food Fest where I present on this. So just watch for those festivals coming up. It will be, like, I think when it gets warm again.
Probably, yeah. So look for it in the spring, I imagine.
And then I also always recommend iNaturalist or other crowdsourcing apps where you're able to take a photo of something wild, something in nature, and then get identification and verification from a community on that identification.
Smart.
And that's what you can get from iNaturalist. It's the one I use the most often.
Okay.
It can also help you find it.
Oh, great. Like identify places where might find a certain plant.
Yep.
Well, this is fascinating. If you are a person who likes being outside and are an adventurous eater or just interested in new ways of looking at the world, urban foraging might be something that you should look into. So places like iNaturalist, and I'm sure there are lots of things, places you can explore online, but that's a good one. I'd like to thank our guest, Meg Bartley. Thank you so much for coming up and being in the studio with us today, Meg.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.